Welcome to episode 118 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and our guest on the podcast is Martin Walker, whose most recent Inspector Bruno crime fiction novel, The Templar's Last Secret, was just published. In our conversation about Bruno Courage, Martin pointed out that in some ways the security challenges that are facing France and the rest of Europe have encroached on the fictional Perigeux village of Saint-Denis. There is nowhere to escape the tension of the past few years, and just like his real-life law enforcement counterparts, Bruno must keep a watchful eye on his patch, even if it means working every weekend. Here's Martin Walker. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I'm delighted to have, for the third time, Martin Walker, who's going to talk about his latest Bruno mystery, The Templar's Last Secret. Welcome, Martin.
Hi, it's good to be back on Speaking of Mysteries again.
Well, you can tell the listening audience where you're headed and that you might be where you might be during this interview.
Okay, well, I'm about to head over the Golden Gate Bridge. I'm in San Francisco, driving towards. And I'm not driving, I should say, otherwise I wouldn't be on the phone, but I'm being driven towards Marin County, where at quarter of a day I'll be doing a reading and a presentation tonight.
Well, it's a fabulous bookstore, so I'm sure you'll have a wonderful time. One of my favorites.
Well, the weather is perfect. It's absolutely clear blue sky, wonderful sort of fantasy California.
I feel like we catch up once a year, and it's always nice to take some time and visit with Bruno Courage, who is the chief of police of Saint-Denis. But, you know, for a small-town police chief, Bruno encounters a lot of really big wrongdoings.
Yes, he does. And it's, in fact, the Bruno as a character was inspired by the chief of police in my own small village or town in the Périgord in France. And his real name, the name of the character is Bruno, but the name of the policeman is Pierrot. And Pierrot, who is also my tennis partner, regularly complains that he spends all of his time trying to stop any crime from happening in this part of this idyllic corner of France. And I litter the landscape with corpses. But at least it means that he's now becoming a well-known figure he's become a kind of a tourist icon. We get people. Well, the books are now in 17 languages, so we get people coming in with their books in Swedish and German and Japanese, and they're going around the market on market day looking for the policeman and say, are you Bruno? And he then sort of preens himself and he stands for selfies and he signs their books and he kisses the wives on each cheek, and he's become this sort of tourist figure, so he's delighted by all of that. His wife isn't so keen on it, but Piero himself is enchanted.
So one of the things I enjoy so much about your books is there's always a collision of the past and the present. And in the last novel before this, Fatal Pursuit, it was events that took place during World War II and the missing Bugatti that was discovered. And in The Templar's Last Secret, though, it's events of much longer ago, back to the time of the earliest inhabitants of the Perigeux, you know, the prehistoric artists who had painted the caves, and relatively more recently, the Crusades and the Knights Templar. So I get the feeling it really is a region where the past informs the present.
It's completely like that. When I go out of my house in the Perigeux, if I turn left for a stroll, I will come to a small niche in the wall beside the road with two little French flags fluttering on it, and that's a small memorial to a young local Frenchman who was in the resistance in the summer of 1944, just around the time of D-Day. And it says, you know, he fell to German bullets. And just a short distance after that, we come to the Domaine de la Vitrale, which was quite a small chateau. It was the secret headquarters of the resistance for the whole of southwestern France. If I turn in the other direction where I leave my house, I come to a 70,000-year-old cemetery, which is the grave of 8 Neanderthal people. And it just is a constant reminder that history here is omnipresent. And also that in this valley of the Vézère, most of what we know of prehistoric peoples has been found. This is not just the famous Lascaux Cave that's prehistoric vintage. We've got over 150 caves with prehistoric engravings in them, and over 20 of these painted caves like Lascaux. And the way that the place of this latest novel begins is at a wonderful old ruined castle called Comarque. Now, Comarque is built upon a cliff which is full of caves, including one that contains a life-size head of a horse that was carved some 15,000 years ago. Just on the other side of the valley is Cap Blanc, a very famous site where we have a whole cave wall about 30 meters wide, out of which are coming life-size sculptures of horses and cattle. And it really is the most extraordinary and early piece of monumental sculpture that humans have produced. And also in this very, very same spot, we found a number of these Venus figurines. What was really strange about the prehistoric people is that about 30,000 years ago, they began producing the first real images of human beings, and they were always women. That's why they were called the Venus figurines. They were women of very ample proportions, with huge breasts and hips and very prominent vulvas. So we're pretty sure they were meant to be a kind of a fertility symbol. And so, yes, we are because we have all of this intense amount of history in the area, it's impossible not to write about it. And the combination of the Middle Ages and the Crusades and of the prehistory is something that I found very interesting to try and work in or to work with in the novel.
But what really got me was how the Knights Templar are still a thing. You know, people are still obsessed with them.
Well, there's this great legend of whatever happened to the Knight Templars' money. I mean, the Knight Templars, they began in after the first Crusade came after in the very end of the 11th century. Jerusalem fell in 1099. And the Knight Templars were formed to help protect the pilgrim routes. And then they began getting into the travel business. And pretty quickly, they got themselves into the banking business. So if you wanted to go on crusade, you could give, say, whatever money you wanted. Say you had 100 golden crowns. You'd give 100 golden crowns to the Templar official in your native France or England or Germany, and he would give you like a check. And when you got to Palestine, you would hand over this check to the Templars, and they would give you 95 golden crowns back. In other words, they take their fee. It meant that you were not going to lose your money to robbers along the way. And so having begun this art of banking, the Templars went on to start financing things like shipping insurance, and then they began financing things like the trade in spices across the Great Silk Road towards China. And they became hugely wealthy, and they spent this on building monumental castles like Carac de Chevalier in what is now Syria. And the French king, King Philip in 1307, who was a man of extremely expensive taste, he first of all bankrupted some of the Florentine bankers. He then ripped off all of the money he could from the Jewish community, and then he turned his greedy eyes, upon the last little honeypot, which was the fabled wealth of the Templars. And he did a deal with the Pope of the day, under which they arrested, and this is something extraordinary, in one single night, they arrested 5,000 Templars all across France. Now, to do this at a time when there was no telephone, there was no internet, there was no printing, to arrange a simultaneous arrest of 5,000 people all across the country at the same time, and to keep the secret while all this was being organized, is really an extraordinary feat of administration. And anyway, having arrested all of these Templars, he couldn't find any of the fabled wealth and money. And so he, Philip had the Grand Master, Jacques de Molay, burned at the stake in the Place Dauphine, which is just on the where the Pont d'Oeuf crosses the island in the middle of the Seine, Paris. And as he was being burned, the Grand Master of the Templars called down a curse upon both of the Pope and the King, said neither one of them would see out the year. And he was right. Both the Pope and the King were dead by the end of the year, and it was also the last Capetian line of the Royal House of France. It was replaced by the Valois. So the curse of the Templars, along with the fabled treasure of the Templars, has always been something that's captivated historians for many years. And also it had one wonderful echo. In 1792, when the French guillotined their king as part of the French Revolution, when the king's head was toppled down into the basket, a young man came forward from the crowd and dipped his handkerchief into the blood of the king and waved the handkerchief in the air and shouted, "Jacques de Molay, the Templars are avenged." It's a wonderful story, but it shows just to what extent this myth, this legend of the Templars retains so much of its fabled power.
And all of this is part of the backdrop for a story that weaves the search for possibly the Templar treasure and what's going on in the Middle East. Because, of course, this part of France was very much a crossroads of the world for a long time. So this, all of these elements come together in this wonderful story.
Well, I had great fun writing it. One thing that I felt I had to bring in, you know, the way in which terrorism has become in Europe recently an extraordinary constant presence in our lives. You've heard about what happened in Manchester in Britain and in Nice last year when, on Bastille Day, one of these Islamic terrorists killed over about 60 people by driving his truck up and down the main roads. The presence of terrorism has become a constant backdrop of life in Europe, and it's remarkable that we've had a state of emergency in France for over 2 years now, and I know quite a lot of French cops. Not one of them has had a weekend off in the course of those 2 years. Every railway station, every airport has got armed soldiers patrolling and so on. And so to write anything about Europe today that doesn't bring in something of this sense of tension and the terrorist presence really is just missing the point. So one of the themes I try to bring in is that these Templar castles in France, many of them were funded and manned by the Templars thanks to the wealth that they made in the Middle East. And, of course, this first encounter between Islam and Christianity, which was the Crusades, is something that has its echo today in the coming of this rather alarming degree and intense level of terrorism. So I wanted to try and bring history round full circle from the initial Crusades 1,000 years ago to what is actually happening in Europe today. And it made for some really fascinating historic juxtaposition, particularly when I bring this terrorism to one of my favorite places in Périgord, which is the National Museum of Prehistory in France, and also to the famous Lascaux Cave, which is the perhaps most famous single work of art that primitive man or prehistoric people has ever produced. It's 18,000 years old, and I think anybody who takes them and sees it will at once understand that these people were not primitive. They might have been decayed people, but they have an aesthetic sensibility that's once immediately familiar to us. These are people we can recognize. They have an artistic sense, very much like our own.
At the beginning of this story, Bruno and the readers meet Emily, who is a new character. She's French, but she's from her family's from the Caribbean, so she's black. And she's been sent to follow Bruno around. But what I found interesting was she's a total whiz at new technology. But what I liked was that Bruno was completely open to this.
I wanted to bring in a new character, and particularly I wanted to bring in somebody who was of a different generation from Bruno and much more familiar with social media and computing. And she's from the Ministry of Justice, and she's doing a survey, a kind of a time and motion study of people like Bruno, these municipal policemen. And she's trying to bring Bruno into the modern age and insists that he gets a Facebook page and starts doing Twitters and Instagram and so on, all of which is a bit of a mystery to our rural chief of police, Mr. Bruno. But she also turns out to be a fascinating character in her own right. And she acts as a kind of almost as a sidekick for Bruno, and using her skills of... using her skills of computing, pulling out her smartphone in the same way that a cowboy in a Western movie would pull out a six-gun, and often to much more potent effect, so that she is able to start comparing. When the story begins with Bruno finding the body of a woman dead at the foot of the cliff on which this great castle of Comarque stands, and she's carrying no identification. So he has to try and find out who he is. And it's Amélie who manages to identify who this woman is by going to the various databases of the French government's photographs of the French government's ID cards and using facial recognition, and then going into the through the international anti-terrorist agreements, going to the U.S. State Department's visa and photo records, and manages to identify who this woman actually was. And from there, Bruno begins to realize just how useful Amélie can be to him. And equally, Amélie begins to realize that Bruno has got his own way of investigating and solving these problems of solving crimes.
Well, that said, one of the most interesting things I found about this novel was, in spite of all the technology, you talk about sort of an unofficial group of people that include retired people from MI5 and a veteran of the old, I can't pronounce it, but the Police Intelligence Service, someone in Tel Aviv who had been in Poland, that you had this, and a former Stasi, a former East German Stasi officer, who can kind of look at this stuff. So I liked that these were almost human computers, and I have a feeling people like this really exist.
Well, they do. I mean, I did quite a lot of research with the French security services and also with the British security services to try and get a sense of how they are able, with modern computer and surveillance video technology, to track down bad guys. And although it's great to have the facial recognition technology on that allows you to sort of identify people in a crowd, what really matters is some handful of really gifted human beings. Some of them, there's one particular person who's quite legendary, who was for many years with the Hong Kong police, a couple of Stasi people, there's a couple of people in Israel, who from a photograph or from even a partial photograph will recognize who the person was. It's as though they have some kind of sixth sense in seeing how somebody moves, or seeing just a tiny part of their face or the curve of an ear, and they can say, I know who that person is. And these people have a network among themselves, particularly between Europeans and Israelis, Americans, who tend to work together quite closely these days in this sort of anti-terrorism operation. I just wanted to write a bit about the way in which these things actually work and to show how a kind of an anti-terrorist manhunt across Europe will start to gather pace and gather speed.
But in spite of all of that, regardless of what's going on, terrorists in Saint-Denis, in the Perigo, Bruno always seems to find time to attend to his social commitments. This most recent book, he's organizing the wedding of two of his friends who show up frequently in the novels, the archaeologists, mispronounce this, Clohide and Horst.
Yes. This is a couple that have been in some of my books before. Clotilde is a French woman who's the curator of the National Museum of Prehistory in the Périgord, and her longtime boyfriend is called Horst. He's a German archaeologist, a professor who's retired and who is now working at this museum. And they finally decide to get married, and Bruno is the best man and has to give the speech. And, of course, at the same time, food being of prime importance in this part of France, Bruno has to arrange the dinner, the bachelor dinner for Horst and the male friends, and he has to do another dinner for Amélie to introduce her to some of Bruno's female friends in Saint-Denis. So he's got a couple of major cooking operations to tackle, which, of course, he loves to do, because Bruno adores to cook. As indeed does my original friend, Pierrot the policeman. After all, it was Pierrot the policeman who taught me how to make an omelette for truffe, and indeed how to roast the woodcock, which is the game bird he likes most to eat. And so, I mean, the food is so important in this part of France. It is the culinary heartland of France with its truffles, its foie gras. But I couldn't possibly write about it without writing quite a bit about food and the wine and this lovely lifestyle that they have there.
Well, certainly nobody eats lunch at their desk.
Good God, no. this may be drummed out of the town, don't we? People take their food very, very seriously. To the point where one of Bruno's friends, who's the science teacher at the local high school, she is so determined that the kids should grow up knowing about food that she's made them. She, one of the things she teaches is environmental sciences, and says, well, if they're going to learn environmental sciences, they've got to learn to grow their own food. And so she starts a small vegetable garden and chicken coop at the school, and then starts on insisting that they bring back cooking lessons for boys and girls alike, because the last thing that they want to do in France is to lose this tradition of wonderful local food and cookery, because the great danger is that across Europe, like in the USA, more and more people start to think food comes from supermarkets, but it doesn't. It comes from people growing it and tending it and raising it and so on. So there's a real sort of movement in France now, as there is in America, to get back to real food and to eat locally. And I think it's a wonderful development, and it's one that's very healthy in my part of France.
So in every book, Bruno usually has a romantic entanglement, and he really doesn't in the Templar's Last Secret. But it ends on an interesting note, and I'm not going to say anything about that because I don't want to spoil it for those of us who are following Bruno's love life. But I'm curious, what is Bruno's next case? Because I'm sure you're working on the next Bruno book.
Well, I've finished the first draft of the next Bruno book, and I can tell you that it starts with a cooking school. And Bruno's old lady friend, Pamela, who's now running the riding school, Pamela decides she's going to start running cooking courses at the riding school for people to fly in and have a week in the Périgord. And among those who were among the chefs teaching people will be Bruno, who has to teach them how to get five meals out of a duck. And so, of course, we'll begin with the breast of duck, the magret, then there will be the legs of duck, then there will be the foie gras, the beautiful stuffed liver of duck, then there will be the aigrette, the long, sweet strips of meat along the back, and finally, the carcass, the bones, which Bruno always makes soup and stock. But when the novel opens with one of the women who was meant to be turning up for this cookery course, doesn't turn up. Now, Bruno needs to find out, this woman who was about due to turn up, among others, at the cookery school, fails to turn up. Bruno has to find out, did she land at Bordeaux Airport? Did she catch the train as planned to get to the Périgord? And he finds out that, yes, she did, but she came in a day early. And on the train, she was with some male stranger. And as Bruno finally tracks down where she was, what happened to her, then the mystery and the crime hunt really begins. And it's one that finds Bruno's old friend Jack Crimson, the retired British diplomat and intelligence official, himself coming under the coming into danger. And at the same time, Bruno does find a woman coming back into his life. But once again, it's Bruno's tragic love life. He always falls in love with these strong-minded, independent women who want to have their own careers. And that's fine for Bruno, but he's aching to be a father and to raise a family and wonders if he'll ever get to find a woman who will challenge him and excite him, but will also settle down with him to raise a family. That's the great challenge for poor old Bruno.
Well, we look forward to reading that one next year, and hopefully you'll come back and talk to me about it. In the meantime, I wish you a wonderful time on your book tour, and thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much. And just one little bit of extra information. When I finish this U.S. book tour, I'm going back to France and back to Dusseldorf, because this year the famous cycling race, the Tour de France, starts from Dusseldorf in Germany, and they've asked me to launch it.
Oh, how wonderful. That's fantastic.
Isn't that great?
So, Martin Walker, chef, cookbook author, and launcher of the Tour de France.
C'est magnifique.
C'est magnifique. Bonsoir.
Okay. Merci beaucoup.